listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Screen Study, Marty Without the Mob. Killers of the Flower Moon is part of a rich but often overlooked strain of Scorsese's storied career by David Canfield. Martin Scorsese isn't afraid of what he doesn't know. He's the gutsiest director I've ever met in my life, says Irwin Winkler, who's produced Scorsese films for more than three decades. Scorsese may be best known for iconic crime stories, inspired by his own Italian-American upbringing in New York. But this is also the man who delivered Hollywood's best Edith Wharton adaptation, darted from The Color of Money's modern setting to The Last Temptation of Christ, and helmed a Liza Minnelli musical being revived nearly 50 years later. His range is on display again in Killers of the Flower Moon, a haunting real-life tragedy set in the Osage Nation of Oklahoma. His fierce determination to do what he feels is the right thing for a movie is really unique, says Winkler. That's no more evident than when it comes to Scorsese's non-mob hits, a remarkable catalog unto itself. Killers of the Flower Moon, 2023. The movie is adapted from David Grant's book about the century-old murders of Osage Native Americans, but Scorsese greatly expanded the indigenous perspective. He worked with Rodrigo Prieto, cinematographer, on his last four movies, filming at the sites of the violence and choosing rich naturalistic colors. Most Osage rituals have to do with the elements, sun, water, Prieto says. It's always an interpretation. That's part of art, but we really tried for authenticity. Silence. This drama, following 17th century Jesuit priest in Japan, may be Scorsese's most underrated faith-driven film, as it confronts the unknowns of spirituality. The Taiwan set presented unwieldy conditions, with weather changing wildly by the hour. Scorsese called Silence a passion project, more than 25 years in the making. The Wolf of Wall Street, 2013. Scorsese wrestled with whether this kinetic, drug-fueled Wall Street epic was the right movie for him to make at the time, but Winkler nudged him. To do this the right way, you had to really go out and push yourself, and Marty's great at that, Winkler says. I don't think another director could do it. The Age of Innocence, 1993. While Scorsese had made a number of New York classics by 1993, he entered uncharted territory with this Gilded Age romantic drama based on the novel. Its sumptuous brilliance can be credited to Scorsese's famous attention to detail. Perfection of the period, as Oscar-nominated hairstylist Alan D'Angerio describes the design team's mantra, it was all Marty. All we did was follow his lead. Raging Bull, 1980. Early in development, the brilliant boxing drama starring Robert De Niro seemed doomed. The executives hated it. Scorsese lacked interest. But after a drug overdose sent him to the hospital, the director felt newly, intensely connected to the visceral character study. Bob visited him in the hospital, Winkler says. They sat down and talked, and Marty found himself in the story. New York, New York, 1977. Gearing up to make this starry big band musical, Winkler wanted Gene Kelly to direct at first, but decided that the hotshot behind Mean Streets and Taxi Driver would be a more unexpected choice. I knew he would bring grittiness to the story, Winkler says. The movie bombed, but it became a Broadway musical this year, and there are rumors of a miniseries adaptation. Like its director, it has stood the test of time. movie-going madness, long day's journey. Sure, geniuses should be allowed to make endless films, but what's everybody else's excuse? By Natalie Jarvie. Opening illustration by Jorge Arevalo, which shows a movie audience looking very bored, and some of them are actually falling asleep. When Brad Pitt first read Damien Chazelle's script for Babylon, it was 180 pages, which translates to about 3 hours of screen time. I said, "This thing is a masterwork, but what's going to get cut?" The actor later told W, "Because it's really hard just to get 120 pages in there." And he said, "Nothing." For better, or what many reviewers said was worse, Chazelle was right. Everything the writer-director dreamed up seemed to have made the final cut, including an elephant's explosive bowels. Chazelle had previously made the acclaimed films La La Land and Whiplash, so he was a legitimate talent to bank on. But Babylon reportedly needed to make about $250 million to break even, and pulled in just $63 million worldwide. Pitt and Margot Robbie are not generally thought of as liabilities, to say the least, so might the movie's excess have been part of the problem? The length of movies has been creeping up for years, even as streaming, TikTok, and absolutely everything else in our culture has rewired our brains to respond to shorter and shorter bursts of content. Because we've adapted to new rhythms of storytelling, binging a 5-hour limited series is a guilty pleasure, whereas watching a 3-hour movie can be painful. Yet how often have you gone to the movies lately and been, in the words of Nicole Kidman, not just entertained, but somehow reborn in under 2 hours? In 2002, the average length of the top 20 box office performers was 1 hour and 59 minutes. 20 years later, moviegoers were gifted, if that's the word, with an extra 13 minutes of footage on average. Maybe you recently saw a kid's movie or a horror flick that was less than 2 hours long. And yes, Barbie actually was everything, including a delicious 1 hour and 54 minutes. But for a host of reasons, including the fact that studios are trying to lure audiences to theaters with the kind of spectacles they can't get at home, even signing up to see a superhero movie or sequel these days likely means you're in for a marathon. This year has served up the longest installments yet in both the Indiana Jones and John Wick franchises. Even the Little Mermaid remake is nearly an hour longer than the original animated film. And if you want to keep up with legendary directors or legends in the making, you might need to download the Run P app. Christopher Nolan's atomic bomb epic and likely Best Picture nominee Oppenheimer clocks in at 3 hours and required 11 miles of IMAX film. Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, another near-certain Oscar contender, is 3 hours and 26 minutes, about which Scorsese had this to say to Deadline. "It's a commitment. I say to the audience out there, if there is an audience for this kind of thing, make a commitment. Your life might be enriched." And the listener should realize that this article went to press before the Oscar nominations and the Oscar ceremonies aired. The length of movies has been debated forever for both creative and commercial reasons. Back in 2000, the talented Mr. Ripley director Anthony Minghella lamented, "There's this strange preoccupation in America with length, and in the most bizarre way. We paid $8. Don't give us too much." Elizabeth Frank, who leads programming for AMC Theaters, says the company has people looking into the length of movies to see if it truly constitutes a problem. Jason Blum, a producer known for horror films like Megan and Paranormal Activity, has already come to a conclusion. "I think it's a problem. Movies are too long." For executives, of course, lengthy movies mean added production cost, marketing challenges, and fewer available showtimes to recoup their investment. The studios are definitely not encouraging three-hour movies, that I can guarantee, says a senior movie executive. As a consumer, speaking for myself and on behalf of many other people like me, enough already. Geniuses like Andrei Tarkovsky and Stanley Kubrick made brilliant long movies, says Grant Singer, whose first feature, the crime thriller Reptile, debuts on Netflix this year. But the idea that a contemporary movie could be long, important, and a blockbuster, it all starts with James Cameron, he says. He has proven that you can make hugely successful global sensations that are three-hour films and people will come to the box office. While audiences might make an exception for something titanic like Avatar or The Batman, they have their limits. One studio executive, citing internal data, tells me that moviegoers become increasingly less interested in a movie the longer it is. Cate Blanchett was a force of nature in Tar, but the film's two-hour, 38-minute runtime may well have contributed to the fact that it made only $6.7 million domestically. Even overseas, where audiences are allegedly more sophisticated, it took in just $22.3 million. The drop-off in interest is said to be especially pronounced for parents. They're more likely to skip a movie they're interested in if it's longer than 2 hours, because the extra time means arranging extra child care, or if they're bringing the kiddos along, enduring even more child content. We joke that the difference between a 2-hour, 59-minute movie and a 3-hour movie is an hour, the exec says. It literally is the decision for people. So, apart from the genius loophole, why have movies become so long? To put it bluntly, as one top agent does, because producers have gotten so short. As the sun set on super producers like Harvey Weinstein, famously nicknamed Harvey Scissorhands because he cut movies down with such relish, no one rose to take their place. The ability to work hand in glove with a world-class director to shape a movie, very few producers possess that skill or willingness today, the agent says. Directors, to extend the metaphor, are getting taller. There are only so many proven hitmakers, and it's been a seller's market as the number of buyers keeps growing with Netflix, Amazon, Apple, and others jumping into the original film game. On streaming, you don't have to worry about showtimes or bathroom breaks anyway. That's what the pause button is for. Executives are still incentivized to make the best possible movie, but the conversation is a little different if a filmmaker feels strongly that they need those extra 5 or 30 minutes. Who wants to be the executive who says no to Scorsese and loses him to a competitor? When a director signs on his contract, and let's be real, it's still almost always a man, states how long the film is expected to be, and whether he has final cut, also known as approval over all edits. Working with a filmmaker who has final cut doesn't necessarily mean anything goes. If a film is running longer than the promised length, producers will encourage edits, and test screenings can be an important tool with particularly self-indulgent directors. One longtime producer suspects that fewer test screenings during the pandemic might have contributed to the glut of two-hour-plus films in recent years. There's nothing better to tell you that your movie is too long than looking at a sea of people who are shifting in their seats, he says. That's why, after Bardo fell flat at the Venice Film Festival, Alejandro Iñárritu decided to shave 22 minutes from his deeply personal film. Blum, whose movies tend to be low-cost, under 2 hours, and popular with moviegoers, gives all his directors final cut. But that doesn't mean I'm a wallflower, he says. People who finance movies need to have more healthy, creative, real conversations with their filmmakers as opposed to just saying yes. I think the filmmakers want that, too. They want partners. They may not listen to the opinion, but they don't just want to do whatever. They want to have a conversation with people they trust, people who understand what they're doing. The Last Descent. Though the world wouldn't catch on until after disaster struck, a tight-knit community of seafarers, explorers, and bold submariners worried for years that Stockton, Russia's OceanGate implosion was all but guaranteed. Susan Casey, author of The Underworld, reveals the hardest truths about the Titan. Opening photo shows the Titan underwater. 41.73 degrees north, 49.95 degrees west, North Atlantic Ocean, June 18, 2023. Fate cleared up the weather, blew off the fog, and calmed the waves as the submersible and its five passengers dived through the surface waters and fell into another world. They entered the deep ocean's uppermost layer known as the Twilight Zone, passing creatures glimmering with bioluminescence, tiny fish with enormous teeth. Then they entered the Midnight Zone, where larger creatures ghost by like alien moons. 2 miles down, they entered the Abyssal Zone, so named because it's the literal abyss. Deeper means heavier. Pressures of 5,000, then 6,000 pounds per square inch. As it descended, the submersible was gripped in a tightening vise. Maybe they heard a noise then. Maybe they heard an alarm. I hope they watched the abyss with awe through their viewport, because I'd like to think their last sights were magnificent ones. As the world now knows, Stockton Rush touted himself as a maverick, a disruptor, a breaker of rules. So far out on the visionary curve that, for him, safety regulations were mere suggestions. If you're not breaking things, you're not innovating, he declared at the 2022 GeekWire Summit. To me, the more stuff you've broken, the more innovative you've been. In a society that has adopted the ridiculous mantra, move fast and break things, that type of arrogance can get a person far. But in the deep ocean, the price of admission is humility, and it's non-negotiable. The abyss doesn't care if you went to Princeton, or that your ancestors signed the Declaration of Independence. If you want to go down into her world, she sets the rules. And her rules are strict, befitting the gravitas of the realm. To descend into the ocean's abyssal zone, the waters from 10,000 to 20,000 feet is a serious affair. And because of the annihilating pressures, far more challenging than rocketing into space. The subs that dive into this realm, there aren't many, are tested and tested and tested. Every component is checked for flaws in a pressure chamber and checked again. And every step of this process is certified by an independent marine classification society. This assurance of safety is known as classing a sub. Deep-sea submersibles are constructed of the strongest and most predictable materials, as determined by the laws of physics. In the abyss, that means passengers typically sit inside a titanium pressure hull, forged into a perfect sphere, the only shape that distributes pressure symmetrically. That means adding crush-resistant syntactic foam around the sphere for buoyancy and protection to offset the weight of the titanium. That means redundancy upon redundancy with no single point of failure. It means a safety plan, a rescue plan, and acute situational awareness at all times. It means respect for the forces in the deep ocean, which Rush didn't have. Unfortunately, June 18th, 2023, wasn't the first time I'd heard of Rush, or his company Oceangate, or his monstrosity of a sub. He and the Titan had been a topic of conversation talked about with real fear, on many occasions, by numerous people I met over the course of 5 years while reporting my book, The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean. I heard discussions about the Titan as a tragedy in waiting on research ships during deep-sea expeditions at marine science conferences. I had my own troubling encounter with Oceangate in 2018 and had been watching it with concern ever since. Everyone I met in the small, tight-knit world of manned submersibles was aware of the Titan. Everyone watched in disbelief as Rush built a 5-person cylindrical pressure hull out of filament-wound carbon fiber, an unpredictable material that is known to fail suddenly and catastrophically under pressure. It was as though we were watching a horror movie unfold in slow motion, knowing that whatever happened next wouldn't be pretty. But like screaming at the screen, nothing that came out of anyone's mouth made any difference. In December 2015, 2 years before the Titan was built, Rush had lowered a one-third scale model of his 4,000-meter sub to B into a pressure chamber and watched it implode at 4,000 psi, a pressure equivalent to only 2,740 meters. The test's stated goal was to validate that the pressure vessel design is capable of withstanding an external pressure of 6,000 psi, corresponding to a depth of about 4,200 meters. He might have changed course then, stood back, and reconsidered. Instead, OceanGate issued a press release stating that the test had been a resounding success because it demonstrates that the benefits of carbon fiber are real. Rush didn't even break stride. He ran right on ahead, plowing hard into his director of marine operations, David Lockridge. Lockridge had emigrated from Scotland to work for OceanGate, selling his home in Glasgow, moving to Washington State with his wife and daughter. Unlike many of his new colleagues, Lockridge was an established pro, a submersible and remote-operated vehicle pilot, a marine engineer, an underwater inspector for the oil and gas industry. He'd piloted rescue subs for the British Navy. By January 2018, the Titan was nearly completed, soon to begin its sea trials. But first, Lockridge would have to inspect the sub and pronounce it fit to dive. And that wasn't going to happen. Lockridge had been watching the sub's progress with ratcheting alarm. He'd argued with OceanGate's engineering director, Tony Nissen. OceanGate had responded by refusing to let Lockridge examine the work on the sub's oxygen system, computer systems, acrylic viewport, O-rings, and the critical interfaces between its carbon fiber hull and titanium end caps. Nissen did not respond to request for comment. When Lockridge voiced his concerns, he was ignored, so he inspected the Titan as thoroughly as he could. Then he presented Rush with a 10-page quality control inspection report that listed the sub's problems. Verbal communication of the key items I have addressed in my attached document have been dismissed on several occasions, Lockridge wrote on the first page, so I feel now I must make this report so there is an official record in place. These issues, he added, were significant in nature and must be addressed. Lockridge listed more than 24 items that required immediate attention. These included missing bolts and improperly secured batteries, components zip-tied to the outside of the sub. O-ring grooves were machined incorrectly, which could allow water ingress. Seals were loose. A highly flammable material lined the Titan's interior. Hosing looped around the sub's exterior, creating an entanglement risk, especially at a site like the Titanic, where spars, pipes, and wires protrude everywhere. Yet those deficiencies paled in comparison to what Lockridge observed on the hull. The carbon fiber filament was visibly coming apart, riddled with air gaps, delaminations, and holes. And there was no way to fix that, short of tossing the hull in a dumpster. The manufacturing process for carbon fiber filament is exacting. Interwoven carbon fibers are wound around a cylinder and bonded with epoxy and cured in an oven for 7 days. The goal is perfect consistency. Any mistakes are baked in permanently. Given that the hull would be seeing such immense pressures, not yet experienced on any known carbon-hulled vehicle, we run the risk of potential interlaminar fatigue due to pressure cycling, Lockridge wrote, especially if we do have imperfections in the hull itself. The hull would need to be scanned to reveal the extent of its flaws. Scanning the hull shouldn't be a problem, should it? Lockridge noted in another document that OceanGate had previously stated the hull would be scanned. Spoiler alert, the hull was not scanned. The OceanGate engineering team does not plan to obtain a hull scan and does not believe the same to be readily available or particularly effective in any event, the company's lawyer, Thomas Gilman, wrote in March 2018. Instead, OceanGate would rely on acoustic monitoring, sensors on the Titan's hull that would emit an alarm when the carbon fiber filaments were audibly breaking. Lockridge's report was concise and technical, compiled by someone who clearly knew what he was talking about. Rush's response was to fire Lockridge immediately, serve him and his wife with a lawsuit, although Carol Lockridge didn't work at OceanGate, for breach of contract, fraud, unjust enrichment, and misappropriation of trade secrets, threaten their immigration status, and seek to have them pay OceanGate's legal fees. According to the company, Lockridge had manufactured a reason to be fired. He had once mooned OceanGate staff through the large viewing window and had repeatedly refused to accept the veracity of information provided by the company's lead engineer, and repeatedly stated he did not approve of OceanGate's research and development plans. Now unemployed, distressed by OceanGate's allegations, and beset with legal bills, Lockridge was in a vulnerable position. He countersued for wrongful termination and sent his inspection report to the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration. OSHA, in turn, passed it to the Coast Guard. Next photo, Stockton Rush, who co-founded OceanGate. Lockridge had saved Rush from himself at least once before. In June 2016, Rush piloted OceanGate's shallow-diving sub, the Cyclops I, to the Andrea Doria, a hulking 700-foot ocean liner that had sunk in 1956 off Nantucket, in a patch of the Atlantic known for its murky fog and seething currents. The ship lies at 240 feet, cobwebbed with discarded fishing lines. At that depth, it is accessible to advanced scuba divers, 18 of whom have died there. Rush was headed down to capture sonar images of the shipwreck with Lockridge and three clients. I learned of what happened next from two sub-pilots from other companies, who each heard it from OceanGate personnel. I also reviewed correspondence related to OceanGate's lawsuit against Lockridge and his wife, in which Lockridge describes the incident. Lockridge declined to be interviewed. As chief pilot, Lockridge had created a dive plan for how to approach the wreck. Any entanglement hazard demands caution, touching down at least 50 meters away and surveying the site before coming any closer. Rush disregarded these safety instructions. He landed too close, got rolled by the current, managed to wedge the sub beneath the Andrea Doria's crumbling bow, and descended into a full-blown panic. Lockridge tried to take the helm, but Rush refused to let him, melting down for over an hour until finally one of the clients shrieked, "Give him the effing controller!" At which point, Rush hurled the controller, a video game joystick, at Lockridge's head. Lockridge freed the sub in 15 minutes. The expedition had been planned to include 10 dives, but instead it ended abruptly, with OceanGate citing adverse weather conditions. After returning to shore in Boston, Rush held a press conference. we were able to view the Andrea Doria area for nearly 4 hours, which is more than 10 times longer than scuba divers can, he announced. The dive, OceanGate's website noted, had focused on the bow of the vessel. Next photos, OceanGate's one-time director of marine operations, David Lockridge, who raised concerns about the company's engineering. And P.H. Narjolet, who died in the Titan implosion. Writing this now, I feel a variety of emotions. Empathy for the families of those aboard the doomed Titan. Despair for the mission specialist whose trust in OceanGate was so misplaced. Shahzada Dawood, Suleiman Dawood, and Hamish Harding. Sadness, because I knew and admired P.H. Narjolet, a deep-sea icon whose expertise on the Titanic led to his fatal association with Rush. P.H. and I sailed together in the Pacific on the 2019 Five Deeps expedition when explorer Victor Vescovo piloted a revolutionary sub, The Limiting Factor, to the deepest spots in all five of the Earth's ocean basins. Vescovo had commissioned The Limiting Factor in 2015 and hired P.H. as his technical advisor. Happily, P.H. didn't have much to do. The Limiting Factor was built by Triton Submarines, a company known for its high-quality smart designs, whose co-founder and president, Patrick Leahy, is regarded as the world's most experienced submersible pilot. Vescovo's sub was certified, at great cost and difficulty over several years, by senior inspection engineer Jonathan Strue from Det Norske Veritas, DNV, an international marine classification society that is the gold standard for safety. And my God, the testing! Every piece of The Limiting Factor was pressure tested to 20,000 psi, equivalent to a depth of 43,000 feet, 20% greater than full ocean depth. Triton built its own state-of-the-art pressure chambers in Barcelona, Spain, but the only high-powered pressure chamber large enough to fit the passenger sphere was located in St. Petersburg, Russia, so the 4-ton titanium orb was shipped halfway around the world. For days, the sphere was squeezed mercilessly, simulating dives to depths beyond any existing on Earth. Afterward, it showed zero evidence of fatigue. Even millions of cycles would not adversely affect it, Leahy told me. Strue dived with Leahy to 35,800 feet. He wanted to, but also he had to. How else could he certify The Limiting Factor, worthy of the first ever DNV class approval for repeated dives to unlimited depth? Strue was so integral to the sub's success that Leahy considered him to be a co-designer. All this made Rush look awfully foolish as he trash-talked the classification societies. Bringing an outside entity up to speed on every innovation before it is put into real-world testing is anathema to rapid innovation, he complained in a blog post. His sub was simply too advanced for the uninitiated. But Rush also used slippery language to infer to clients that the Titan would be classed. As an interim step in the path to classification, we are working with a premier classing agency to validate Titan's dive test plan. He actually had the DNV logo up on his website for a time, Leahy recalled. I told Jonathan Strue about it, and he called Stockton and said, take it down, and take it down now. When I boarded Vescovo's ship in Tonga, I had already digested Narjolet's incredible 5-page resume. It was given to me by Captain Don Walsh, who commanded the Bathyscaphe Trieste in 1960, when he and Jacques Picard made history by diving 35,800 feet to the Mariana Trench's Challenger Deep, the ocean's absolute nadir. Walsh was 87 years old when I met him in 2019. He had dedicated his entire legendary career to deep sea science, engineering, and exploration. PH is kind of my parallel on the French side, he told me. He's a walking history. Nargileh had been a decorated commander in the French Navy, the captain of France's 6,000-meter sub, the Nautile, and leader of his country's deep submergence group. As commanding officer of the French Navy's explosive ordnance disposal team, he demined the English Channel, the North Sea, and the Suez Canal. I felt awed to meet him, and a bit intimidated. But Nargileh was a deeply humble man. He talked about how much he loved the ocean, how diving brought him a sense of peace beyond anything attainable on land. He described how the Nautile's pilots would stop for lunch on the seafloor, laying a tablecloth, breaking out silverware, and decanting a bottle of wine. "What's your favorite place to dive?" I asked him. "Volcanic vents," he replied, without hesitation. PH also loved the Titanic. He made his first manned dive to the wreck in 1987 and had revisited the site more than 30 times. No one knew the ship's history as intimately as he did. He laughed as he explained why he got a kick out of seeing the Titanic swimming pool. "Because it looks like it's empty, and it's full of water. You don't see the surface, you know." One morning, as the limiting factor was being launched, I felt a gentle hand on my shoulder. I was standing too close to the winch. Nargileh guided me to a safer spot, cautioning me in his lovely French accent, "When something goes wrong, it goes wrong very fast." If empathy and sadness were the only emotions I felt, I'd be able to sleep better. But I am also angry. Angry at Russia's disrespect for the deep ocean, a realm he professed to want to explore, but in reality did not understand. Angry because 5 people are dead, and many others were jeopardized after Rush was warned for years that his sub wasn't fit for purpose. My anger is also personal, because when I first heard about OceanGate back in 2018, I was just beginning to learn about submersibles, just beginning to report my book. I didn't yet know how insane the Titan was. I didn't know the 4,000-meter sub's viewport was certified to only 1,300 meters. I wanted desperately to dive to abyssal depths, but at the time couldn't see a way to do it. The few vehicles in the world that can dive below 10,000 feet were all dedicated to science. Then suddenly there was Rush, holding forth about how his brilliant new sub would take people to see the Titanic, and saying things like, "If 3/4 of the planet is water, how come you can't access it? And I want to change the way humanity regards the deep ocean." I wasn't very interested in diving to the gruesome Titanic, but I was extremely interested in diving to 13,000 feet. I called OceanGate and spoke to a marketing executive who told me the 2019 Titanic trips were nearly sold out, but there would be future expeditions even deeper. "The end goal is not 4,000 meters. We're already building to go to 6,000 meters. This was possible because of Russia's many advanced innovations," she explained. "The Titan's pressure hull would be made of space-grade carbon fiber, monitored by an array of acoustic sensors. Steel just implodes," she said with assurance, as if this was something that had ever happened. "But carbon fiber gives a warning 1,500 meters before implosion. It makes very specific snapping sounds. There's no other acoustic hull monitoring system in the world." True. No other deep-sea submersible in the world had such a system, because no other deep-sea sub needed one. Fortunately, I knew enough to speak to a few people before I got anywhere near the Titan. One phone call was all it took. Terry Kirby, the chief pilot of the University of Hawaii's 2 deep-sea subs, recoiled when I asked him about OceanGate. "Be careful of that," he warned. That guy has the whole submersible community really concerned. He's just basically ignoring all the major engineering rules. He paused, then added emphatically, "Do not get into that sub. He is going to have a major accident." Kirby referred me to Marine Engineer Will Conan for a detailed explanation of why the Titan was just a disaster. Conan is the chair of the Marine Technology Society's Manned Underwater Vehicles Committee. He helped write the class rules for submersibles and had decades of experience in the field. And Conan, a straight-shooting French-Canadian, knew all about the Titan. "It's been a challenge to deal with Ocean Gate," he said, then launched into a 2-hour explanation of the reasons why. The bottom line, a novel submersible design was welcome, but only if you were willing to do the Herculean amount of testing to prove that it was safe under the gimlet eye of a classification society. Ocean Gate decided that process would be too long and expensive, Conan said, and they were just going to do whatever they wanted. His committee had recently written a letter to Rush, signed by Conan and 37 other industry leaders, expressing their unanimous concern about the Titan's development and Ocean Gate's current experimental approach. Rush needed to stop pretending that he was working with DNV and start doing it. Stop misleading the public. Stop breaching an industry-wide professional code of conduct we all endeavor to uphold. The group concluded by asking Rush to confirm that Ocean Gate can see the future benefit of its investment in adhering to industry-accepted safety guidelines. The letter, which has now been widely publicized, was a stern warning, the epistolary equivalent of being hauled into the principal's office and smacked with a ruler. Rush ignored the Marine Technology Society's letter. He ignored the fact that it was signed, at the top, by Don Walsh. Don Walsh. If you know anything about the deep ocean, you know that when Don Walsh speaks, you shut up and listen. Not only doesn't he tell the truth, what's his name, Rush, Walsh said, he's absolutely 14-carat self-certitude. Have you met him, I ask? Oh, yes, Walsh said tartly. What was your impression? Walsh chuckled. Oh, he tolerated me. He was correct. He was polite. He really wanted to tell me how he was all out on the cutting edges of technology, places I couldn't even imagine. Rush ignored the fact that the letter was signed by a co-founder of IOS Expeditions, Rob McCallum, whom he'd known since 2009 and had tried unsuccessfully to hire for Ocean Gate's Titanic operations. McCallum's client list was awash in wealthy ocean explorers. He led 7 expeditions to the Titanic with Rush's 2 mere submersibles and had dived to the wreck himself. When McCallum learned more about the Titan, he wanted nothing to do with it. I've never allowed myself to be associated with an unclassed vehicle, ever. Rush ignored the fact that the letter was signed by Terry Kirby, a former Coast Guard navigator who led the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab for 38 years and had made more than 900 sub-dives in the Pacific. You have enough to worry about if you're exploring volcanoes or shipwrecks without having to worry about whether your submersible is going to survive, Kirby told me. Would you ever agree to pilot a sub that wasn't classed, I ask? Never. Nope. No. Rush ignored the fact that the letter was signed by Patrick Leahy, who had warned Rush repeatedly about the Titan's dangers. He also quietly paid the Lockridge's legal fees in the hope that the inspection report would be dissected in court and made public. But to Leahy's bitter disappointment, Lockridge decided to settle, withdrawing his OSHA complaint. I think Stockton had really intimidated him and frightened him, Leahy said. I certainly would have continued that fight, because I believe you take something like that right to the end. But he didn't want to, and I knew it wasn't my decision. By spring 2018, it was evident that Russia's deep-sea sub would never be certified. Titan could not get classed because it was built of the wrong material, and it was built the wrong way, McCallum said. So once Stockton made up his mind, he was on a path from which there was no return. He could have stopped, but he could never fix it. Rush was angry that McCallum had been steering Ios's clients away from diving in the Titan, though many had expressed interest. I have given everyone the same honest advice, which is that until a sub is classed, tested, and proven it should not be used for commercial deep dive operations, McCallum wrote to Rush in March 2018, 4,000 meters down in the mid-Atlantic is not the kind of place you can cut corners. At Conan's invitation, I attended the Marine Technology Society's 2019 meeting, and by that time, Rush had been ignoring its letter for a year. The program is an overview of manned submersible operations worldwide, Conan said, addressing the group. Today, we're doing the deep submersible review work. This consisted of an alphabetical rundown of every deep sub and the status of its operations. When he got to the letter O, Conan cleared his throat. Anybody here from OceanGate? Silence. No? OceanGate's recalcitrance was like smog hovering over the conference room. During a coffee break, I heard the Titan mentioned in the same breath as the UC-3 Nautilus, a creepy Danish sub whose owner had killed and dismembered journalist Kim Wall on a dive. In a corner, two marine engineers were worked up, and I caught a snatch of their conversation. When it's compressing, it can actually buckle, one engineer said in an exasperated tone, referring to Russia's carbon fiber hull, like if you stand on an empty soda can. The other engineer snorted and said, I wouldn't get into that thing for any amount of money. Clearly, Rush would do as he pleased. He would register the Titan in the Bahamas and sail from a Canadian port into international waters, thus skirting Coast Guard regulations that any commercial sub must be classed. OceanGate's lawyer, Thomas Gilman, emphasized in a legal filing against the Lockridges that the Titan will operate exclusively outside the territorial waters of the United States. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.